leaping over the trenches we've dug, running so hard there ain't nothing in my noise, just the buzz of the bomb getting louder and lower, and 1017 raising up his hand to shield his eyes from the sun. Why ain't he running? And pound, pound go my feet, and I'm chanting, "Damn you! Damn you!" Buzz! And 1017 don't see me coming. I slam into him hard enough to lift him off his feet, feeling the air punched from his lungs as we fly across the grass, as we hit the ground rolling, as we go end over end across the dirt into a shallow trench as one titanic boom eats the entire planet in a single bite of sound, blasting away every thought and bit of noise, picking up your brain and shattering it into pieces. And every bit of air is sucked up and blown past us, and dirt and grass hits us in hard, heavy clods, and smoke fills our lungs. And then there's silence. Loud silence.
"Are you hurt?"
I hear the mayor shout, as if he's miles and miles away and deep underwater. I sit back up in the trench, see the huge smoking crater in the middle of the field. Smoke already thinning, 'cause there's nothing to burn. Row upon row of spackle watching huddled from the far fields. I'm breathing, but I can't hear it. I turn back to 1017, still mostly under me in the trench, scrabbling to get up, and I'm opening my mouth to ask him if he's all right, even though there's no way for him to answer. And he hits me in a hard slap that leaves a rake of scratches across my face. "Hey!" I shout, though I can barely hear myself. He's twisting out from under me, and I reach out a hand to hold him there. And he bites it hard with his rows of little sharp teeth. And I pull it back, already bleeding. And I'm ready to punch him, ready to pound him. And he's out from under me, running away across the crater, back toward the other spackle. "Hey!" I shout again, my noise rising into red. He's just running and staring back, and the rows of spackle are all looking back at me, too. Their stupid, silent faces with less expression than the dumbest sheep I ever had back on the farm, and my hand is bleeding, and my ears are ringing, and my face is stinging from the scratches, and I saved his stupid life, and this is the thanks I get? Animals, I think. Stupid, worthless, effing animals. "Todd," says the mayor again, riding over to me, "are you hurt?" I turn my face up toward him, not even sure if I'm calm enough to answer, but when I open my mouth, the ground heaves. My hearing's still gone, so I feel it more than hear it, feel the rumble through the dirt, feel the air pulse with three hard vibrations, one right after the other, and I see the mayor turn his head suddenly back toward town, see Davy and all the spackle do the same. More bombs. In the distance, toward the city, the biggest bombs that have ever exploded in the history of this world.
18. To live is to fight. I'm so stupidly undone after the mayor and his soldiers take Todd away that Corinne finally has to give me something for it, though I feel the prick of the needle in my arm as little as I feel her hand on my back, not moving, not caressing, not doing anything to make it feel better, just holding me there, keeping me to earth. I'm sorry to say I'm not grateful. When I wake in my bed, it's only just dawn. The sun's so low it's not quite over the horizon yet. Everything else in morning shadow. Corinne is in the chair next to me. "As much as it would do you good to sleep longer," she says, "I'm afraid you can't." I lean forward in the bed until I'm almost bent in half. There's a weight in my chest so heavy it's like I'm being pulled into the ground. "I know," I whisper. "I know." I don't even know why he collapsed. He was dazed, nearly unconscious, foam coming from his mouth, and then the soldiers lifted him to his feet and dragged him away. "They'll come for me," I say, having to swallow away the tightness in my throat. "After they're done with Todd." "Yes, I expect they will," Corinne says simply, looking at her hands, at the cream-colored calluses raised on her fingertips, at the ash-colored skin that flakes off the top of her hands because of so much time under hot water. The morning is cold. Surprisingly, harshly so. Even with my window closed, I can feel a shiver coming. I wrap my arms around my middle. He's gone. He's gone. And I don't know what'll happen now. I grew up in a settlement called the Kentish Gate, Corinne suddenly says, keeping her eyes off mine. On the edge of a great forest. I look up. Corinne? My father died in the Spackle War, she presses on, but my mother was a survivor. From the time I could stand, I worked with her in our orchards, picking apples and crested pine and roisin fruit. I stare at her, wondering why now, why this story now? My reward for all that hard work, she continues, was a camping trip every year after final harvest, just me and my mother, as deep in the forest as we dared to go. She looks out into the dark dawn. There's so much life here, Viola. So much. In every corner of every forest and stream and river and mountain. This planet just hums with it. She runs a fingertip over her calluses. The last time we went, I was 8. We walked south for 3 whole days, a present for how grown up I was getting. God only knows how many miles away we were, but we were alone, just me and her, and that was all that mattered. She lets a long pause go by. I don't break it. She was bitten by a bandit red on her heel as she cooled her feet in a stream. She's rubbing her hands again. It's fatal. Red snake venom, but slow. Oh, Corinne, I say under my breath. She stands suddenly, as if my sympathy is almost rude. She walks over to my window. It took her 17 hours to die, she says, still not looking at me. And they were awful and painful. And when she went blind, she grabbed onto me and begged me to save her. Begged me over and over to save her life. I remain silent. What we know now, what the healers have discovered, is that I could have saved her life just by boiling up some xanthus root. She crosses her arms. Which was all around us. In abundance. The roar of New Prentice Town is only just starting to rise with the sun. Light shoots in from the far horizon, but we stay silent for a moment longer. I'm sorry, Corinne, I finally say. But why? Everyone here is someone's daughter, she says quietly. Every soldier out there is someone's son. The only crime, is to take a life. There is nothing else. And that's why you don't fight, I say. She turns to me sharply. To live is to fight, she snaps. To preserve life is to fight everything that man stands for. She takes an angry huff of air. And now her too, with all the bombs. I fight them every time I bandage the blackened eye of a woman, every time I remove shrapnel from a bomb victim. Her voice has risen, but she lowers it again. That's my war, she says. That's the war I'm fighting. She walks back to her chair and picks up a bundle of cloth next to it. And to that end, she says, I need you to put these on. She doesn't give me time to argue or even ask about her plan. She takes my apprentice robes and my own few much-washed clothes and has me put on poorer rags, a long-sleeved blouse, a long skirt, and a headscarf that completely covers my hair. Corinne, I say, tying up the scarf. Shut up and hurry. When I'm dressed, she takes me down to the end of the long hallway leading out to the riverside by the House of Healing. There's a heavy canvas bag of medicines and bandages loaded up by the door. She hands it to me and says, "Wait for the sound. You'll know it when you hear it. Corinne, your chances aren't very good, you have to know that." She's looking me in the eye now. "But if you get to wherever they're hiding, you put these supplies to use as a healer, do you hear me? You've got it in you whether you know it or not." My breathing is heavy, nervous, but I look at her and I say, "Yes, mistress." "Mistress is right," she says, and looks out of the window in the door. We can see a single bored soldier at the corner of the building, picking his nose. Corinne turns to me. "Now, strike me, please." I blink. "What?" "Strike me," she says again. "I'll need a bloody nose or a split lip, at least." "Corinne, quickly, or the streets will grow too crowded with soldiers." "I'm not going to hit you." She grabs me by the arm, so fiercely I flinch back. "If the president comes for you, do you honestly think you'll return? He's tried to get the truth from you by asking, and then by trapping your friend. Do you honestly think the patience of a man like that lasts forever?" "Corinne..." "He will eventually hurt you," she says. "If you refuse to help him, he will kill you." "But I don't know..." "He doesn't care what you don't know," she hisses through her teeth. "If I can prevent the taking of a life, I will do so, even one as irritating as yours." "You're hurting me," I say quietly, as her fingers dig into my arm. "Good," she says. "Get angry enough to strike me." "But why? Just do it," she shouts. I take in a breath, then another. Then I hit her across the face as hard as I can. I wait, crouched by the window in the door, watching the soldier. Corinne's footsteps fade down the corridor as she runs to the reception room. I wait some more. The soldier is one of the many now who have had the cure taken from them, and in the relative quiet of the morning, I can hear what he thinks. Thoughts of boredom. Thoughts of the village he lived in before the army invaded. Thoughts of the army he was forced to join. Thoughts of a girl he knew who died. And then I hear the faint shout of Corinne coming from the front. She'll be screaming that the answer snuck in during the night, beat her senseless, and kidnapped me under their very noses, but that she saw us all flee in the opposite direction I'm going to be running. It's a poor story. There's no way it's going to work. How could anyone sneak in with guards everywhere? But I know what she's counting on. A legend that's been rising. A legend about the answer. How can the bombs be planted with no one seeing? With no one being caught? If the answer can do that, could they sneak past armed guards? Are they invisible? I hear thoughts just like this as soon as I see the soldier's head snap up when he hears the ruckus. It grows louder in his noise as he runs around the corner and out of view. And as fast as that, it's time. I hoist the bag of medicines up onto my shoulder. I open the door. I run. I run toward a line of trees and down to the river. There's a path along the riverbank, but I stick to the trees beside it, and as the bag bashes my shoulders and back with heavy corners, I can't help but think of me and Todd running down this same river, this same riverbank, running from the army, running and running and running. I have to get to the ocean. As much as I want to save Todd, my only chance is to find her first, and then I'll come back for him. I will. I ain't never leaving you, Todd Hewitt. My heart aches as I remember saying it. As I break my promise, "You hold on, Todd. You stay alive." I run. I make my way downriver, avoiding patrols, cutting across back gardens, running behind back fences, staying as far clear of houses and housing blocks as I can. The valley is narrowing again. The hills approach the road and the houses begin to thin out. Once I hear marching and I have to dive deep into the undergrowth as soldiers pass, holding my breath, crouching as low to the ground as I can. I wait until there's only bird call. "Where's my safety?" and the now distant roar of the town. Wait for a breath or two more. Then I raise my head and look down the road. The river bends in the distance, and the road is lost from view behind farther rolling hills and forests. Across the road here, this far from town, there are mostly farms and farmhouses, working their way up sloping hillsides, back toward more forest. Directly across, there's a small drive leading to a farmhouse with a little stand of trees in the front garden. The farming fields spread out to the right, but above and beyond the farmhouse, thicker forest begins again. If I can get up the drive, that'll be the safest place for me. If I have to, I'll hide until nightfall and make my way in the dark. I look up and down the road again and once more. I listen for marching, for stray noise, for the rattle of a cart. I take in a breath, and I bolt across the road. I keep my eyes on the farmhouse, the bag banging into my back, my arms pumping the air, my lungs gasping as I run faster and faster and faster. Up the drive, nearly to the trees, nearly there. And a farmer steps out from behind them. I skid to a stop, sliding in the dirt and nearly falling. He jumps back, obviously surprised to see me appearing suddenly in front of him. We stare at each other. His noise is quiet, disciplined, almost gentlemanly, which is why I didn't hear it from a distance. He's holding a basket under one arm and a red pear in his free hand. He looks me up and down, sees the bag on my back, sees me alone out on the road in a break of the law, sees from the heaviness of my breath that I've obviously been running. And it comes in his noise, fast and clear as morning. "The answer," he thinks. "No," I say, "I'm not..." But he holds a finger up to his lips. He cocks his head in the direction of the road, and I hear the distant sound of soldiers marching down it. "That way," the farmer whispers. He points up a narrow path, a small entrance to the woods above that would be easy to miss if you didn't know it was there. "Quickly now." I look at him again, trying to see a trap, trying to tell, but there's no time. There's no time. "Thank you," I say, and I take off running. The path leads almost immediately into thicker woods, all uphill. It's narrow, and I have to push back vines and branches to make my way. The trees swallow me, and I can only go forward and forward, hoping that I'm not being led into a trap. I get to the top of the hill only to find a small slope down, and then another hill to climb. I run up that, too. I'm still heading east, but I can't see enough over anything to tell where the road is or the river or which way I'm... I nearly stumble out into a clearing, where there's a soldier not 10 yards from me. His back is to me, thank God, thank God. And it's not until my heart has leaped out of my chest and I've caught myself and fallen back into the bushes that I see what he's guarding. There it is. In the middle of a clearing, cresting the hill, stretching up on 3 metal legs almost 50 yards into the sky. The trees around it have been felled, and across the clearing underneath it I can see a small building and a road that leads back down the other side of the hill to the river. I've found the communications tower. It's here. And there aren't that many soldiers around it. I count 6. Just 6. With big gaps. My heart rises. And rises. I've found it. And a boom echoes in the distance beyond the tower. I flinch along with the soldiers. Another bomb. Another statement from the answer. Another... The soldiers are leaving. They're running, running toward the sound of the explosion, running away from me and down the other side of the hill toward where I can already see a white pillar of smoke rising. The tower stands in front of me. All of a sudden, it's completely unguarded. I don't even wait to think how stupid I'm being. I'm just running, running toward the tower. If this is my chance to save us, then, I don't know, I'm just running across the open ground, toward the tower, toward the building underneath. I can save us somehow. I can save all of us. And out of the corner of my eye, I see someone else break cover from the trees to my left. Someone running straight toward me. Someone saying my name. "Viola," I hear. "Get back." "Viola, no!" Mistress Coyle is screaming at me. I don't stop. Neither does she. Get back! She's yelling, and she's crossing the clearing in front of me, running and running and running. And then I realize, like a blow to the stomach, the reason why she's yelling, no! Even as I'm skidding to a stop, no, I think, no, you can't! And Mistress Coyle reaches me, you can't! And pushes us both to the ground, no! And the legs of the tower explode in three blinding flashes of light.
Part 4. Night Falling. 19. What You Don't Know.
Get off me! She slaps her hand over my mouth, holding it there, holding me there with the weight of her body as clouds of dust billow around us from the rubble of the communications tower. Quit shouting, she hisses. I bite her hand. She makes a pained face, fierce and angry, but she doesn't let go, just takes the bite and doesn't move. You can scream and shout all you want later, my girl, she says, but in 2 seconds this place is going to be swarming with soldiers, and do you honestly think they're going to believe you just happened by? She waits to see my reaction. I glare at her, but finally nod. She takes away her hand. Don't you call me my girl, I say, keeping my voice low but just as fierce as hers. Don't you call me that ever again. I follow her down a steep slope, heading back toward the road, sliding on fallen leaves and gathered dew, but always down and down. I hop over logs and roots, the canvas bag like a stone around my shoulders. I have no choice but to go with her. I'd be captured and God knows what else if I went back to town. And she took my other choice away. She reaches a stand of bushes at the bottom of a steepening in the slope. She ducks fast under them and beckons for me to follow. I slide down next to her, my breath almost gone, and she says, "Whatever you do, don't scream." Before I can even open my mouth, she's jumped out through the bushes. They close up behind her, and I have to fight my way through leaves and branches to follow. I'm still pushing them back when I practically tumble out the other side, onto the road, where two soldiers stand by a man with a cart, all of them looking straight at me and Mistress Coyle. The soldiers look more astonished than angry, but they have no noise, so there's no way to know. But they're carrying rifles, and they're raising them at us.
"Who the hell is this?"
one barks, a middle-aged man with a shaved head and a scar down his jawline. "Don't shoot," Mistress Coyle says, hands out and up.
"We heard the explosion,"
says the other soldier, a younger one, not much older than me, with blonde, shoulder-length hair. Then the older soldier says something else, something unexpected.
"You're late."
"That's enough, Magnus," Mistress Coyle says, lowering her hands and stepping forward to the cart. "And put your rifles down. She's with me." "What?" I say, still frozen to my spot.
"The tracer malfunctioned completely,"
the younger soldier says to her.
"We're not even sure where it came down."
"I told you they were too old,"
Magnus says. "It did its job," Mistress Coyle says, bustling around the cart. "Wherever it landed." "Hey," I say, "what's going on?" And then I hear, "Hildy?" Mistress Coyle stops in her tracks. The two soldiers do, too, and stare at the man driving the cart.
"It's you, ain't it?" he says. "Hildy, who's also called Viola."
My mind's been racing so fast, so completely focused on the soldiers, that I barely took in the man driving the cart. The nearly expressionless face, the clothes, the hat, the voice, the noise flat and calm as the far horizon. The man that once drove me and Todd across a sea of things. "Wilf!" I gasp. Now everyone looks at me, Mistress Coyle's eyebrows so high it's like they're trying to crawl into her hair.
"Hey,"
Wilf says in greeting. "Hey," I say back, too stunned to say any more. He touches two fingers to the brim of his hat.
"I'm glad to see you made it."
Mistress Coyle's mouth is moving, but no sound comes out for a second or two. There'll be time for that later, she finally says. We have to go now.
Will there be room for two?
The younger soldier asks.
There'll have to be.
She ducks down under the cart and removes a panel from the underside. She motions to me.
Get in.
In where? I bend down and see a compartment hidden like a trick of the eye in the width of the cart, narrow and thin as a cot above the rear axle.
Pack won't fit,
Wilf says, pointing at the bag on my back.
I'll take it.
I slip it off and hand it to him.
Thank you, Wilf.
Now, Viola, Mistress Coyle says.
I give Wilf a last nod, duck under the cart and crawl in, forcing my way across the compartment until my head's nearly touching the far side. Mistress Coyle doesn't wait and forces herself in after me. The younger soldier was right. There isn't enough room. She's pressed right up against me, face to face, her knees digging into my thighs, our noses less than an inch apart. She's barely drawn her feet inside when the panel is replaced, plunging us into almost complete darkness.
Where are we?
I start to say, but she shushes me harshly. And outside I hear soldiers marching fast up the road, led by the clopping of horses' hooves.
Report!
One of them shouts as they stop by the cart. His voice. It's up high and I hear the horse whinnying beneath it, but his voice.
Heard the explosion, sir,
the older of our soldiers replies.
This man says he saw women heading past him down the river road about an hour ago.
We hear the real soldier spit.
Bitches.
I recognize his voice. It's Sergeant Hammer.
Whose unit you two in?
He says.
First, sir,
says our younger soldier, after the briefest of pauses.
Captain O'Hare. That pansy?
Sergeant Hammer spits.
You want to do some real soldiering, transfer to the force. I'll show you what's what.
Yes, sir,
says our older soldier, sounding more nervous than I'd want him to. I can hear the noise of the soldiers in Sergeant Hammer's unit. They're thinking of the cart. They're thinking of the explosions. They're thinking about shooting women. But there's no noise coming from Sergeant Hammer.
Arrest this man,
Sergeant Hammer finally says, meaning Wilf.
We were doing just that, sir. Bitches,
Sergeant Hammer says again, and we hear him spur his horse. Yield, it thinks, and he and his men march off at full speed. I let out the breath I didn't realize I was holding.
He wasn't even punished,
I whisper, more to myself than to Mistress Coyle.
Later,
she whispers back. I hear Wilf snap the reins and we rock as the cart plods slowly forward. So the mayor was a liar. All along.
Of course he was, you idiot.
And Maddie's killer walks free to kill again, his cure still in place. And I'm bumping and shaking against the woman who destroyed the only hope of contacting the ships that might save us. And Todd is out there. Somewhere. Being left behind. I've never felt so lonely in my life. The compartment is hellishly small. We share too much of each other's air, elbows and shoulders bruising away as we ride along, the heat soaking our clothes. We don't speak. Time passes, and more after that. I fall into a kind of doze, the close warmth sucking the life right out of me. The rocking of the cart eventually flattens all my worries, and I close my eyes against it. I'm awakened by the older soldier knocking on the wood, and I think we're going to finally get out, but he just says,
We're at the rough bit. Hold on.
To what? I say. But I don't say any more as the cart feels like it drops off a cliff. Mistress Coyle's forehead smacks into my nose, and I smell blood almost at once. I hear her gasp and choke as my stray hand is shoved into her neck, and still the cart tumbles and bumps, and I wait for the moment where we topple end over end. And then Mistress Coyle is working both arms around me, pulling me close to her and bracing us in the compartment with one hand and one foot pressed against the opposite side. I resist her, resist the implied comfort, but there's wisdom in it, as almost immediately we stop knocking each other about, even though the cart lurches and stutters. And so it's in Mistress Coyle's arms that the last bit of my journey is taken. And it's in Mistress Coyle's arms that I enter the camp of the answer. Finally, the cart stops and the panel is removed almost immediately.
"We're here,"
says the younger soldier, the blonde one.
"Everyone okay?"
"Why wouldn't we be?" Mistress Coyle says sourly. She lets go of me and scoots her way out of the compartment, extending a hand to help me out, too. I ignore it, getting myself out and looking at my surroundings. We've come down a steep, rocky path that's barely fit for a cart, and into what looks like a gash of rocks in the middle of a forest. Trees press in on every side, a row of them on the level ground in front of us. The ocean must be beyond them. Either I dozed off for longer than I thought, or she lied and it's closer than she said. Which wouldn't surprise me. The blonde soldier whistles when he sees our faces, and I can feel caked blood under my nose.
"I can get you something for that,"
he says. "She's a healer," Mistress Coyle says. "She can do it herself."
"I'm Lee,"
he says to me, a grin on his face. For a brief second, I'm completely aware of how terrible I must look with my bloody nose in this ridiculous outfit. "I'm Viola," I say to the ground.
"Here's your bag,"
Wilf says, suddenly next to me, holding out the canvas sack of medicines and bandages. I look at him for a second, and then I pretty much throw myself at him in a hug, pulling him tight to me, feeling the big, safe bulk of him.
"I'm glad to see you, Hildy,"
he says.
"You too, Wilf," I say, my voice thick.
I let him go and take the bag.
"Corinne pack that?"
Mistress Coyle asks. I fish out a bandage and start cleaning the blood from my nose. "What do you care?"
"You can accuse me of many things," she says, "but not caring isn't one of them, my girl."
"I told you," I say, catching her eye. "Never call me that again." Mistress Coyle licks her teeth. She makes a quick glance to Lee and to the other soldier, Magnus, and they leave quickly, disappearing into the trees ahead of us.
"You too, Wilf."
Wilf looks at me.
"You gonna be all right?"
"I think so, Wilf," I say, swallowing. "But don't you go far." He nods, touching the brim of his hat again and walking after the soldiers. We watch him go.
"All right."
Mistress Coyle turns to me, crossing her arms.
"Let's hear it."
I look at her, at her face full of defiance, and I feel my breath quicken, the anger rising up again so fast, so easily, it feels like I might crack in two. "How dare you!" But she's interrupting already.
"Whoever contacts your ships first has the advantage. If he's first, he tells them all about the nasty little terrorist organization he's got on his hands, and can they please use their guidance equipment to track us down and blow us off the face of New World?"
"Yes, but if we
got to them first, yes, of course, we could have told them all about our local tyrant, but that was never going to happen."
"We could have tried.
Did you know what you were doing when you ran toward that tower?"
I clench my fists.
"No, but at least I could have..."
"Could have what?"
Her eyes challenge me.
"Sent out a message to the very coordinates the president's been searching for? Don't you think he was counting on you trying? Just why exactly do you think you haven't been arrested yet?"
I dig my nails into my palms, forcing myself not to hear what she's saying.
"We are running out of time," she says. "And if we can't use it to contact help, then at the very least we prevent him from doing the same."
"And when they land, what's your brilliant plan then?"
"Well," she says, uncrossing her arms and taking a step toward me. "If we haven't overthrown him, then there's a race to get to them first, isn't there? At least this way it's a fair fight."
I shake my head. "You had no right."
"It's a war."
"That you started."
"He started it, my girl.
And you escalated it."
"Hard decisions have to be made."
"And who put you in charge of making them?"
"Who put him in charge of locking away half the population of this planet?"
You're blowing people up!
Accidents, she says. Deeply regrettable. Now it's my turn to take a step toward her. That sounds exactly like something he would say. Her shoulders rise, and if she had noise, it would be taking the top of my head off. Have you seen the women's prisons, my girl? What you don't know could fill a crater!
Mistress Coyle!
A voice calls from the trees. Lee steps back into the rocky gash.
There's a report just come in.
What is it? Mistress Coyle says. He looks from her to me. I look at the ground again.
3 divisions of soldiers marching down the river road, he says. Dead set for the ocean.
I look up sharply. They're coming here? Both Mistress Coyle and Lee look at me.
No,
Lee says.
They're going to the ocean.
I blink back and forth between them. But aren't we? Of course not, Mistress Coyle says, her voice flat, mocking. Whatever made you think we were? And whatever, I wonder, makes the President think we are? I feel an angry chill, despite the sun, and I notice I'm shaking inside these big, stupid, puffy sleeves. She was testing me. As if I would tell the mayor where... How dare you! I start to say again. But the anger suddenly fades as it comes flooding back. Todd, I whisper. Ocean, all over his noise. How he promised to hide it. And how I know he'd keep that promise. If he could. Oh, Todd, did he? Are you... Oh, no. I have to go back, I say. I have to save him. She's already shaking her head. There's nothing we can do for him right now. He'll kill him. She looks at me, not without pity. He's probably dead already, my girl. I feel my throat closing up, but I fight it.
You don't know that.
If he's not dead, then he must have told the President voluntarily. She cocks her head. Which would you rather be true?
No, I say, shaking my head. No.
I'm sorry, my girl. Her voice is a little calmer than before. A little softer, but still strong. I truly am. But there are thousands of lives at stake. And like it or not, you've picked a side. She looks over to where Lee stands. So why don't you let me show you your army?
20. Rubble. Bitches, Mr. Hammer says from atop his horse. Your analysis was not asked for, Sergeant, says the mayor, riding Morpeth through the smoke and the twisted metal. They've left the mark, though, Mr. Hammer says, pointing at the trunk of a large tree at the edge of the clearing. The blue A of the answer is smeared across it. Your concern for my eyesight does you credit, says the mayor sharply enough that even Mr. Hammer shuts up. We rode up here straight from the monastery, meeting Mr. Hammer's squadron coming up the hill, looking ready for battle. When we got to the top, we found Ivan and the soldiers who were meant to be guarding the tower. Ivan got promoted here, I guess, after all the spackle were rounded up. But now he's looking like he wishes he never heard of a tower. 'Cause it ain't here no more. It's just a heap of smoking metal, mostly in a long line where it fell, like a drunk man tipping forward onto the ground and deciding to just stay there and sleep. And I do my damnedest not to think about her asking me how to get here, saying we should go here first. Oh, Viola, you didn't. If they got enough to blow up something this big, Davy says to my right, looking across the field. He don't finish his sentence, 'cause it's the same thing we're all thinking. The thing that's in everyone's noise. Everyone that's got noise, that is, 'cause Mr. Hammer seems to be one of the lucky ones. Hey, boy, he sneers at me. You a man yet? Don't you have somewhere you need to be heading, Sergeant? The mayor asks, not looking at him. With haste, sir, Mr. Hammer says again, giving me an evil wink, then spurring his horse and shouting for his men to follow. They speed down the hill in the fastest march I've seen, leaving us with Ivan and his soldiers, all of their noise, regretting to a man how they ran toward the monastery after hearing the tracer bomb hit. It's obvious, though, when you look back. A smaller bomb in one place to get people running away from where you want to plant your bigger bomb. But what the hell were they doing bombing the monastery? Why attack the Spackle? Why attack me? Private Pharaoh, the mayor says to Ivan.
It's Corporal Pharaoh, actually, Ivan says.
The mayor turns his head slowly and Ivan stops talking as he comes to understand. Private Pharaoh, the mayor says again.
You will salvage what metal and scrap you can, and then report to your commanding officer to relinquish your supply of cure. He stops. We can all hear Ivan's noise clear as day. The mayor looks around. Every soldier in the squadron has noise. Every one of them's already been punished for one thing or another. You will submit yourselves to your commanding officer for appropriate punishment.
Ivan don't reply, but his noise rumbles.
Is something unclear, Private? The mayor says, his voice dangerously bright.
He looks into Ivan's eyes, holding his gaze.
You will submit yourselves to your commanding officer for appropriate punishment, he says again, but there's something in his voice, some weird vibration.
I look at Ivan. His eyes are going foggy, unfocused, his mouth a little slack.
I will submit to my commanding officer for appropriate punishment, he says.
Good, the mayor says, looking back at the wreckage. Ivan slumps a little when the eye contact is broken, blinking as if he's just woken up, forehead furrowing.
But, sir, he says to the mayor's back.
The mayor turns round again, looking very surprised at still being spoken to. Ivan presses on.
We were coming to your aid when...
The mayor's eyes flash.
When the answer watched you do exactly what it wanted you to do, and then blew up my tower. But, sir...
Without changing his expression, the mayor pulls out a pistol from his holster and shoots Ivan in the leg. Ivan tumbles over, wailing. The mayor looks at the other soldiers.
Anyone else care to contribute before you get to work?
As the rest of the soldiers ignore Ivan's screams and start clearing up the wreckage, the mayor moves Morpeth right in front of that A, loud and clear like the announcement it is.
The answer,
he says, in a low voice like he's talking to himself.
The answer.
Let us go after him, Pa, Davy says.
Hmm?
The mayor turns his head slowly, like he forgot we were there.
We can fight, Davy says. We prove that. And instead you got us babysitting animals that are already beat.
The mayor considers us for a minute, though I don't know how or when Davy turned him and me into an us.
If you think they're already beaten, David, he says finally, then you know very little about the Spackle.
Davy's noise ruffles a little.
I think I've learned a thing or two by now.
And as much as I hate to, I have to agree with him.
Yes, says the mayor. I suppose you have. Both of you.
He looks me in the eye, and I can't help thinking of me saving 1017 from the bomb, risking my own life to get him out of the way, and him biting and scratching me by way of thanks.
Then how about a new project? The mayor says, steering Morpeth over to us. One where you can put all your expertise to work.
Davy's noise ain't sure of this. There's pride, but doubt, too. All I got in mind is dread.
Are you ready to lead, Todd?
The mayor asks lightly.
I'm ready, Pa, Davy says.
The mayor still looks only at me. He knows I'm thinking about her, but he's ignoring all my askings.
The answer, he says, turning back to the A. If that's who they want to be, then let them.
He looks back at us.
But if there's an answer, then someone must first.
He lets his voice fade, and he gets a faraway smile on his face, like he's laughing at his own private joke. Davy unfolds the big white scroll onto the grass, not caring that it's getting wet in the cold morning dew. There's words written across the top in diagrams and squares and things drawn in below it. "Measurements, mostly," Davy reads. "Too effin' many. I mean, look at that!" He holds the scroll up to me, trying to get me to agree. And, well, yeah, okay, whatever. "Too effin' many," I say, feeling sweat come up under my arms. It's the day after the tower fell, and we're back at the monastery, back to putting teams of spackle to work. My escape seems to be forgotten, like it was part of another life, and now we've all got new things to think about. The mayor won't talk to me about Viola, and I'm back to working for Davy, who ain't too happy. So, it's like old times. "There's fighting to be done, and he's got us building an effin' palace." Davy frowns, looking over the plans. "It ain't a palace, but he's got a point. Before, it was just gonna be rough shacks to shelter the spackle for the winter, but this looks like a whole new building for men, taking up most of the inside of the monastery. It's even got a name written across the top. A name my eye stumbles over, trying to..." Davy turns to me, his eyes widening. I make my noise as noisy as possible. "We should get started," I say, standing up, but Davy's still looking at me. "What do you think about what it says right here?" he asks, putting his finger on a block of words. "Ain't that something amazing what it says?" "Yeah," I shrug, "I guess." His eyes get even wider with delight. "It's a list of materials, pig piss!" His voice is practically celebrating. "You can't read, can you?" "Shut up," I say, looking away. "You can't even read!" Davy smiling up into the cold sun and around at all the spackle watching us. "What kind of idiot gets through life?" I said, "Shut up!" Davy's mouth drops open as he realizes, and I know what he's gonna say before he says it. "Your ma's book," he says. "She wrote it for you, and you can't even..." And what can I do but hit him across his stupid mouth? I'm getting taller and bigger, and he comes off worse than the fight, but he don't seem to mind all that much. Even when we get back to work, he's still giggling and making a big show out of reading the plans. "Mighty complicated, these instructions," he says, a big smile across his bloody lips. "Just effing get on with it." "Fine, fine," he says. "First step is what we're already doing, tearing down all the internal walls." He looks up. "I could write it down for you." My noise rages red at him, but noise is useless as a weapon. Unless you're the mayor. I didn't think life could turn more to crap, but it always does, don't it? Bombs and towers falling, and having to work with Davy, and the mayor paying me special attention, and I don't know where she is. And I don't know what the mayor's gonna do to her. And did she plant the bombs? Did she? I turn back round to the worksite. 1,150 pairs of spackle eyes are watching us, watching me, like they're just effin' farm animals looking up from their grazing because they heard a loud noise. Stupid effin' sheep. "Get to work!" I shout. "You look like hell," Mayor Ledger says as I fall onto my bed. "Stuff it," I say. "Working you hard, is he?" He brings me over the dinner that's already waiting for us. It don't even look like he ate too much of mine before I got here. "Ain't he working you hard?" I say, digging into the food. I think he's forgotten about me, truth to tell. He sits back on his own bed. I haven't spoken to him in I don't know how long. I look up at him. His noise is gray, like he's hiding something, though that ain't unusual. "I've just been doing my rubbish duties," he says, watching me eat. "Listening to people talk." "And what are they saying?" I ask, because it seems like he wants to talk. "Well," he says. His noise shifts uncomfortably. "Well, what?" And then I see the reason his noise is so flat is 'cause there's something he don't want to tell me, but feels like he has to. So here it comes. "That house of healing," he says, "that one in particular?" "What about it?" I say, trying not to make it sound important, failing. "It's closed down," he says. "Empty." I stop eating. "What do you mean, empty?" "I mean, empty," he says gently, 'cause he knows it's bad news. "There's no one there, not even the patients. Everyone's gone." "Gone?" I whisper. "Gone." I stand up, though there ain't nowhere to go, my stupid plate of dinner still in my hand. "Gone where? What's he done with her?"
"He hasn't done anything," Mayor Ledger says. "Your friend ran, that's what I heard. Ran off with the women just before the tower fell."
He rubs his chin. "Everyone else was arrested and taken to the prisons, but your friend got away." He says got away, like that's not what he means. Like what he means is she was planning to get away all along. "You can't know that," I say. "You can't know that's true about her." He shrugs. "Maybe not," he says. "But I heard it from one of the soldiers who was guarding the House of Healing." "No," I say, but I don't know what I mean. "No."
"How well did you really know her?" Mayor Ledger says.
"You shut up." I'm breathing hard, my chest rising and falling. "It's good that she ran, ain't it? Ain't it? She was in danger and now..." But did she blow up the tower? Why didn't she tell me she was going to? Did she lie to me?" And I shouldn't think it. I shouldn't think it, but here it comes. She promised. And she left. She left me. Viola, did you leave me?
21. The Mine. I open my eyes to the sound of wings flapping outside the door. Something I already know in the few days I've been here means that the bats have returned to the caves after their night's hunting, that the sun is about to rise, that it's almost time to get myself out of bed. Some women start to stir, stretching in their cots. Others are still dead to the world, still snoring, still farting, still drifting on in the empty nothing of sleep. I spend a second wishing I was still there, too. The sleeping quarters are basically just a long shack, swept earth floor, wood walls, wood door, barely any windows, and only an iron stove in the center for not enough heat. The rest is just a row of cots stretched from one end to the other, full of sleeping women. As the newest arrival, I'm at one end. And I'm watching the occupant of the bed at the other end. She sits up straight, body fully under her command, like she never actually sleeps, just puts herself on pause until she can start work again. Mistress Coyle turns in her cot, sets her feet on the floor, and looks over the other sleepers straight at me, checking on me first. To see, no doubt, if I've run off sometime in the night to find Todd. I don't believe he's dead, and I don't believe he told the mayor on us either. There must be another answer. I look back at Mistress Coyle, unmoving. Not gone, I think. Not yet. But mainly because I don't even know where we are. We're not by the ocean, not even close as far as I can tell, though that's not saying much because secrecy is the watchword of the camp. No one gives information out unless it's absolutely necessary. That's in case anyone gets captured on a bombing raid or, now that the answer have started running out of things like flour and medicine, raids for supplies as well. Mistress Coyle guards information as her most valuable resource. All I know is that the camp is at an old mine, started up, like so many other things seem to have been on this planet, with great optimism after the first landings, but abandoned after just a few years. There are a number of shacks around the openings to a couple of deep caves. The shacks, some new, some from the mining days, serve as sleeping quarters and meeting rooms and dining halls and so on. The caves,
the ones where there aren't bats anyway, are the food and supply stores, always worryingly low, always guarded fiercely by Mistress Lawson, still fretting over the children she left behind and taking out her fretting on anyone who requests another blanket for the cold. Deeper in the caves are the mines, originally sunk to find coal or salt, and then when none was found, diamonds and then gold, which weren't found either, as if they'd do anyone any good in this place anyway. The mines are now where the weapons and explosives are hidden. I don't know how they got here or where they came from, but if the camp is found, they'll be detonated, probably wiping us all off the map. But for now, it's a camp that's near a natural well and hidden by the forest around it. The only entrance is through the trees at the bottom of the pass Mistress Coyle and I bumped our way down, and it's so steep and hard you'd hear intruders come from a long way away. "And they'll come," Mistress Coyle said to me on my first day. "We'll just have to make sure we're ready to meet them." "Why haven't they come already?" I asked. "People must know there's a mine here." All she did was wink at me and touch the side of her nose. "What's that supposed to mean?" I asked. But that was all I got, because information is her most valuable resource, isn't it? At breakfast, I get my usual snubbing by Thea and the other apprentices I recognize, none of whom will say a word to me, still blaming me for Maddie's death, blaming me for somehow being a traitor, blaming me for this whole damn war, for all I know. Not that I care, because I don't. I leave them to the dining hall, and I take my plate of gray porridge out in the cold morning to some rocks near the mouth of one of the caves. As I eat, I watch the camp start to wake itself, start to pull itself together for the things that terrorists spend their days doing. The biggest surprise is how few people there are. Maybe 100, that's all. That's the big answer causing all the fuss in New Prentice Town by blowing things up. 100 people. Mistresses and apprentices, former patients and others, too, disappearing in the night and returning in the morning, or keeping the camp running for those that come and go, tending to the few horses the answer has and the oxes that pull the carts and the hens we get our eggs from and a million other things that need doing. But only 100 people. Not enough to have a whisper of a prayer if the mayor's real army comes marching down toward us. "All right, Hildy." "Hi, Wilf," I say as he comes up to me, a plate of porridge in his hands, too. I scoot over so he can sit near me. He doesn't say anything, just eats his porridge and lets me eat mine.
"Wilf?"
we both hear. Jane, Wilf's wife, is coming for us, two steaming mugs in her hands. She picks her way over the rocks toward us, stumbling once, spilling some coffee and causing Wilf to rise halfway up, but she recovers.
"Here you go,"
she practically shouts, thrusting the mugs at us. "Thank you," I say, taking mine. She shoves her hands under her armpits against the cold and smiles, eyes wide and searching around, like she eats with them.
"Awful cold to be eating outside," she says, like an overly friendly demand that we explain ourselves.
"Yep," Wilf says, going back to his porridge. "It's not too bad," I say, also going back to eating.
"Did you hear they got a grain store last night?"
she says, lowering her voice to a whisper but somehow making it louder at the same time.
"We can have bread again."
"Yep," Wilf says again.
"Do you like bread?"
she asks me. "I do."
"You gotta have bread,"
she says, to the ground, to the sky, to the rocks.
"You gotta have bread."
And then she's back off to the dining hall, not another word, though Wilf doesn't seem to much mind or even notice. But I know, I definitely know, that Wilf's clear and even noise, his lack of words, his seeming blankness, doesn't describe all of him. Not even close. Wilf and Jane were refugees, fleeing into Haven as the army swept behind them, passing us on the road as Todd slept off his fever in Carbonell Downs. Jane fell ill on the trip, and after asking directions, Wilf took her straight to Mistress Forth's House of Healing, where Jane was still recovering when the army invaded. Wilf, whose noise is as free of deception as anyone's on this planet, was assumed by the soldiers to be an idiot and so allowed to visit his wife when no other man was. When the women ran, Wilf helped. When I asked him why, all he did was shrug and say,
"They were gonna take Jane."
He hid the less able women on his cart as they fled, built a hidey hole in it so others could return for missions, and for weeks on end has risked his life taking them to and fro because the soldiers have always assumed a man so transparent couldn't be hiding anything. All of which has been a surprise to the leaders of the Answer, but none of which is a surprise to me. He saved me and Todd once when he didn't have to. He saved Todd again when there was even more danger. He was even ready the first night I was here to turn right back around to help me find him. But Sergeant Hammer knows Wilf's face now, knows that he should have been arrested, so any trip back is pretty much a death sentence. I take a last spoonful of my porridge and sigh heavily as I pop it into my mouth. I could be sighing at the cold, sighing at the boring porridge, sighing at the lack of anything to do in camp. But somehow, Wilf knows. Somehow, Wilf always knows.
"I'm sure he's okay, Hildy," he says, finishing up his own porridge. "He survives, does our Todd."
I look up into the cold morning sun, and I swallow again, though there's no porridge left in my throat.
"Keep yourself strong," Wilf says, standing. "Strong for what's coming."
I blink. "What's coming?" I ask as he walks on toward the dining hall, drinking his mug of coffee. He just keeps on going. I finish my coffee, rubbing my arms to gather some heat, thinking I'll ask her again today. No, I'll tell her I'm coming on the next mission, that I need to find...
"You're sitting out here all by yourself?"
I look up. Lee, the blonde soldier, is standing there, smiling all toothy. I immediately feel my face go hot. "No, no," I say, standing straight up, turning away from him and picking up the plate.
"You don't have to leave," he's saying.
"No, I'm finished."
"Viola."
"All yours."
"That's not what I meant."
But I'm already stomping back to the dining hall, cursing myself for the redness of my face. Lee isn't the only man. Well, he's hardly a man, but like Wilf, he and Magnus can no longer pretend to be soldiers and go to the city, now that their faces are known. But there are others who can, because that's the biggest secret of all about the Answer. At least a third of the people here are men. Men who pretend to be soldiers to shuttle women in and out of the city. Men who help Mistress Coyle with the planning and targets. Men with expertise on handling explosives. Men who believe in the cause and want to fight against the mayor and all he stands for. Men who've lost wives and daughters and mothers, and who are fighting to save them, or fighting to avenge their memories. Mostly it's memories. I suppose it's useful if everyone thinks it's only women. It allows men to come and go, even if the mayor surely knows what's what, which is probably why he's denying the cure to so much of his own army, why the Answer's own supply of cure is becoming more burden than blessing. I cast a glance quickly back to Lee behind me, and forward again. I'm not sure of his reason for being here. I haven't been able to... I haven't had the chance to ask him yet. I'm not paying attention as I reach the dining room door and don't really notice when it opens before I can take the handle. I look up into Mistress Coyle's face. I don't even greet her. "Take me with you on the next raid," I say. Her expression doesn't change.